I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 4th of August. We always start the week with all things political. I've been away for a couple weeks to North Wisconsin and then Northern Minnesota, where I was completely cut off from all the news. So if there are gaps during this hour, my fault. Please guide us in directions that you news people, and I know you are listening, deem are important. We're going to start with the Mideast. A temporary ceasefire and troop withdrawal from Gaza slowed violence for a bit of today, but as you heard on the news from NPR, that ceasefire is now over, and there have been several ceasefires that broke down during this 3.5-week war. Yesterday, an Israeli Air Force missile struck near the entrance of a UN school sheltering displaced Palestinians in Rafah, killing 10 people and wounding 35 others. This was where 3,000 Palestinians had sought shelter. The task of destroying Hamas's tunnel network into Israel seems to be all important to the Prime Minister Netanyahu. How close are they to dismantling that tunnel network? The House passed tough immigration bills last Friday that President Obama calls extreme and unworkable. We'll talk about those. And we'll look at an interesting piece in the New York Times yesterday that the president does have leeway to act on immigration. What is it that he can do without Congress? We'll also be talking about the growing confrontation between Washington and Moscow over Ukraine. And we will look at the House votes to authorize John Boehner to sue the president, complaining that he has overstepped his legal authority. Is this just a way to create a campaign issue to take home for the 5-week congressional recess? Those are some of the issues I thought we might discuss this hour, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. Our guest is Yevgeny Feyman. He has been with us before. He's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute who writes on healthcare policy, entitlement reform, and the Affordable Care Act. He has been discussing the costs of healthcare reform frequently, but he discusses all kinds of things. So we ask you this hour, do you see a role for peace in the Israel-Palestine conflict? What kind of role should we be playing? Are we playing? Russia's intentions in Ukraine and beyond. What do you think of these votes on immigration and on suing the president, and what we should do about the children, huge number of children who are on the border? That's an immediate concern. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do, for Yevgeny. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. KP Whaley is doing on-air production, back from vacation as well, so we're getting back to the swing of things. John Dean will be our guest hour two. It will be 40 years ago this coming Saturday that Richard Nixon resigned the presidency. He has put together the Watergate conversations from the whole period, right after Watergate, to the time that the president resigned, really. Big book. We'll talk with John Dean, hour two. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Yevgeny Feyman, thank you once again for being with us. Hello.
Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Well, the news yesterday was there was this temporary ceasefire and the violence seemed to be down. And then we listened to the news from NPR a couple minutes ago saying that the ceasefire is over and there is more violence. What do you think we're waiting for here? Is it to have all those tunnels destroyed and then we will see peace? Or are there other things that can lead us toward peace?
I mean, the path to peace is going to be very, very long and fraught with much more violence than what we're just seeing. Unfortunately, destroying the tunnel network isn't going to be the end of it. Israel may very well disengage after they do that. They'll likely start pulling troops back, sending reservists home, and mainly focus on protecting the border. But the siege on Gaza will remain. Gaza will still remain under largely Israeli control. There's going to be a blockade still. The UN has called this an open-air prison, and there's definitely some truth to that. So the hostilities from from Gaza, from Hamas, won't be resolved here. And unfortunately, you know, the longer this conflict goes on, the more difficult peace becomes. Mm-hmm. Both sides gain more and more animosity towards each other, and the prospect of a two-state solution, I think, is further right now than it ever was.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, Israel would not be completely happy until Hamas was gone. Can you ascertain the strength of Hamas right now? Is there more support for Hamas as a result of Israeli actions here, or less support?
You know, this is going to be largely speculation, right? It's a government, but it's also a terrorist organization with a lot of militant groups operating as proxies. It has its own militant group as well, its own militant wing, excuse me. But it's certainly possible to say that support for Hamas, not only in Gaza and from some Arabs in Israel, but in the international community too, has grown. And it may not necessarily be support for Hamas, the organization itself, but it's simply support for the plight of the Palestinians. And the way Hamas is looking at this is that when a Palestinian dies, that's more support that they gain out of it. It's a very cynical way to look at it, and it's disgusting to place that little value on human life. But right now, their ideology, it promotes martyrs. It supports dying for the cause, and the more people that can die for their cause, the better off they're going to be, at least in their eyes.
I've read that there are some countries in the Middle East, Egypt among them, that have no support for Hamas now, and I'm wondering if that is fairly widespread among other Middle Eastern countries and what that does for the continued success of Hamas.
Well, Egypt is probably Israel's only vocal ally in this. It's a bit unfortunate because a lot of that comes from Egypt's hyper-secular government. It's run by the military now, and their main opposition to Hamas comes from Hamas's religious extremism. But Egypt itself has a lot of human rights issues. They've cracked down on Muslims, on the Islamic Brotherhood. So they've got their own issues to deal with, but I think they're an outlier for the most part. Iran, surprisingly, has expressed quite a bit of support for Hamas. Qatar and Turkey have begun to displace Iran as the primary financiers of Hamas. They're providing them with a lot of aid. So I don't think that Egypt is very indicative of the Middle East as a whole. Other countries like Jordan have, for the most part, remained relatively quiet here. So, you know, the actors may have shifted, but I think that support as a whole for Hamas is pretty strong right now.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of the Israelis' placements of their Air Force missiles? We had one yesterday strike near the entrance of a UN school that was sheltering displaced Palestinians. And then last week, we also had another attack in another school where 21 Palestinians had sought refuge in a school run by the United Nations. Are they just not targeting as carefully as they should, or what's going on here?
I mean, there are two things, really, that I say. You know, for first, every time that something like this happens, every civilian death is a tragedy. It's horrible. So I think that needs to be said right away. There's never an excuse for killing civilians. But what Hamas is doing is they often store weapons in civilian houses, in civilian buildings. Previous raids on UN schools have actually found weapons being stored in the schools themselves. So that's not justification for bombing the schools. But right now, I think Israel's main focus is eliminating the weapon and tunnel network, and they probably are placing less emphasis on protecting civilians than they should. It's a very difficult situation, though. Put in the place of an Israeli government official, I can see pretty easily how they make the decision to go ahead and bomb a civilian area, even when there's a pretty significant prospect of civilian deaths.
Let's move to immigration. We can come back to Israel-Palestine with our listeners in a moment. And let's look just immediately at this problem that we've spent a lot of time discussing, the 57,000 children who have made their way to the border since last October. The Congress is now on vacation, and the money that the president had requested to deal with hearings for these children, I guess housing and everything, it hasn't been voted on. So you've got all these people. I would imagine it's kind of jamming up the system with no vote on what to do with them. And then we had the House pass bills last Friday that the president has called extreme and unworkable, House Republicans passing legislation addressing the influx of unaccompanied children by sending them home via an expedited process, and another bill ending a two-year-old policy from the administration freeing from deportation immigrant children who have lived in the U.S. since 2007. Address, if you would please, the large number of children who seem to be in limbo right now and the fact that Congress did not appropriate money. What's to happen here?
I mean, it's a humanitarian disaster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's shocking to me that we as a first world nation, as the world's sole superpower and a country that's made up of immigrants, that's built itself up on the backs of immigrants, are saying that we can't support, because of our horrible immigration policies, these children that are escaping from child slavery, from being drug mules. They're escaping from Central America, from Mexico. The majority are from Central America right now. It's appalling that we're saying that we can't support them, that we don't have the money, but we have over $12 billion to support the Customs and Border Patrol, the Border Protection Agency. You know, we spend more money annually on protecting our border than Pakistan spends on its military in any given year. We shave off some of that money. We could support these kids, turn them into American citizens. These aren't criminals. They're oftentimes dragged here completely against their will. I think passing a bill the way that the House Republicans did, that simply makes it easier to deport these kids, is just unconscionable.
So should the president call a special session? Can he do that to deal with this immediate crisis? Or,
you know, it's unfortunate. The president's authority here is fairly limited. You know, he does have that executive order that he's been operating under, which has made it more difficult to deport the children. He can simply refuse to deport them. But if the bill, as it's passed the House, were to pass the Senate and then pass the president's desk, it would take those powers away from the president. Now, obviously, that's not going to happen. So I think, as it stands, we're going to remain in this limbo where a lot of the kids won't be deported, but they'll be in a very, very murky legal status.
Mm-hmm.
In theory, what the president can do is make it a little bit easier for them to receive some federal and state licenses, that make it a little easier for them to get work permits and driver's licenses, be able to pay income taxes, but they still won't be eligible for benefit programs or, for that matter, citizenship.
Mm-hmm. So what's behind this vote to expedite the process and send these children home as quickly as possible? It must be somehow politically expedient, and I wonder how.
So it's a way for the GOP to go and say, look, we're trying to do something about this crisis beyond just throwing money at it. And it allows them to stick fairly closely with, quote-unquote, traditional conservative views. It focuses a lot on border security and the fact that we're, quote-unquote, a nation of laws, that we have laws and we have to obey them. So it helps them rally some in the base who do support our very restrictive immigration laws, who support strengthening the border. But it's certainly not a realistic bill. I'm not sure if it's going to gain them very much in the coming elections. I think there was a bit of a miscalculation, because my view is that the GOP is shifting a bit more to a pragmatic approach towards policy. Even some of the Tea Party have expressed some support for paths to citizenship, and we can only really go so long with having a restrictive immigration policy like this. They're going to lose moderate voters in an election because of this. Moderate voters tend to support pretty serious immigration reform, and it just seems this a huge miscalculation.
Hmm. To say nothing of Hispanic voters.
Exactly. Although, I think Hispanic voters are probably lost to the GOP for a while now, unless they make serious changes to their platform.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We'll move into a discussion of Russia here in a moment. Russian officials have been condemning and belittling sanctions placed on them after the downing of the airplane. There's, of course, a continuing confrontation between Washington and Moscow over Ukraine, which news over the weekend showed that it has derailed this recent accord that promised one of the most expansive collaborations between the two countries, nuclear scientists. Our guest is Russian-born, actually, so he'll have special insight in those areas. Well, welcome your phone calls. We're also going to be talking about the House voting to authorize John Boehner to sue President Obama. Is this just a campaign issue, created campaign issue? What do you think? And what do you think about what the road to peace is between Israel and Palestine, if any? What should we be doing about immigration? I mean, we don't do anything. We keep doing nothing and nothing and nothing. And we have all these children who are on the border, and the House passing two bills the president will not sign, the president taking some action on his own. It's obviously an issue that would behoove both our parties to pay attention to, but what could they agree on? Here's how you reach us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hour two of our program, John Dean will be with us. John Dean has spent the past 4 years transcribing all of the Watergate conversations, including 634 conversations that nobody has paid attention to or transcribed from the moments after the break-in on June 16th of 1972 until the tape system was dismantled. And the book, The Nixon Defense, has been released just in time for the 40th anniversary of Nixon's resignation. So that's coming up hour two. To you, more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Evgeny Feynman. He is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, writes mostly on healthcare, actually. We haven't talked about that at all, but we will in the Affordable Care Act. But he covers all kinds of other political subjects as well. To your phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to some phone calls and start with Doe in Williams Bay. Hi, Doe.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, this is, I hope, a brief enough call, but just want you to know, and I feel very strongly, this. I was born in 1932 of non-religious Jewish parents. And as a young teenager, I was recruited to join an organization to help create Israel for the Jews. So, of course, I did. I earned money. I sang songs. I did everything. But now I'm sorry, because they never, never said to me when I was a teenager that we would displace other people in order to get our country. And so I'm sorry. I consider it non-Jewish treatment of human beings.
What's the solution, Doe?
Well, I certainly think the solution is to stop killing on both sides, but definitely Jewishness is not killing. And since I've been here since 1932, mm-hmm. I don't even kill bugs. But the solution is to get people to sit down and figure out how to live adjacently mm-hmm. in peace.
Evgeny?
I'm of Jewish background also, I do feel strongly about this issue. So I'm certainly not coming from a purely objective perspective here. But, I think that's on point. You have to get people together, but the dynamics here are really, really unique to, as opposed to every other conflict where we're seeing in the world. This conflict has raged on for almost mm-hmm. a century in one way or another. There are long-standing animosities, long-standing distrust, and who represents who gets to sit at the table, and then you've got your basic things like what's the shape of the table, who sits at the head of the table. All these things are still things we have to figure out. And unfortunately, the U.S. has simply done a bad job of mediating. Egypt's done a bad job of mediating. It's hard to say who should be the mediator, how they should mediate. I agree something needs to be done, and killing is absolutely un-Jewish. It's contra Jewish beliefs. But as it stands right now, I have to quote Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, when he said that if Hamas were to put their weapons down right now, the conflict would largely be at a standstill. It may not resolve, but no one would be getting killed. If Israel were to put down its arms right now, Hamas would keep shelling.
Well, and you can't have, in order to sit down at any table, Israel has said, and their point is understandable, you can't have rockets being fired into Israel, right?
Exactly. That's one of the main things it comes down to. Hamas still has to recognize Israel as a legitimate negotiating partner. Their charter still calls for the destruction of the quote-unquote Zionist state. It took a long time to get the PLO, what is now Fatah, to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. And it may take a long time to get Hamas to recognize Israel, or it may never happen. You know, these are things that are very difficult to predict. It's very hard to read the leaves on this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Joe, very much for your call. Glenn in Blue Mounds is next. Hi, Glenn.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a quick question in regards to Boehner's potential lawsuit against the president.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that they can force the taxpayers to sue themselves, unless, like Edelson and the Koch brothers are paying Boehner's bills? He's going to charge the taxpayers to sue this government, which is the taxpayers. So can you explain that?
The lawsuit isn't really suing the taxpayers. It's suing the president, so the executive branch. The executive branch doesn't hold the power of the purse. If the lawsuit were to be accepted in a court, I'm not sure how they would assign damages, where the damages would come from. I find it hard to believe that they'd come from taxpayer money if it were to actually happen. All that being said, I don't think this lawsuit is going anywhere.
Why is it happening? Is it just a campaign thing to use?
Yeah, I mean, it's largely a distraction from having to actually put out some specific policy proposals. It's just another way to try to hit the ACA, and it's hidden an unpopular part of the ACA. Absolutely, it's hidden one of the worst parts of the ACA, the employer mandate. But ultimately, it's politics. It's a political game. It's another way to try to rally the base. I think it's misguided, but that is what it is.
Yeah, and you're the expert on the Affordable Care Act too. Give us an assessment of where it is, August 4th.
It's much better than it was October 1st, 2013.
Mm-hmm.
We've, according to official numbers, we've enrolled around 8 million people through the health insurance exchanges, something like another 5 or 4 million in Medicaid, though it's unclear how many of those have been enrolled primarily because of the ACA or if they enrolled because they were previously eligible. Right now, it's looking pretty good for the first year. It's looking better than I thought it would. The second year is coming up. It's going to be hyper-politicized. Even the start of the open enrollment period, it's starting a week after the elections. That's very politicized. We're starting to see rates come out. Some are very low. In California, it's a weighted average increase of about 4 or 5%. In other states, they're seeing double-digit increases. You know, it's moving forward. It's not going to fail. It's not going to get repealed. It's going to remain as the law of the land. There's still a lot of bad aspects to it. The employer mandate's going to begin in 2015. That's probably the single worst part of the law. So, you know, we're still waiting for the full law to get implemented, but it's definitely looking like, at least policy-wise, a win for Democrats in the first year. But public opinion is still very much against it.
Mm-hmm. And what about the states that decided to set up their own exchanges? Are they doing better or not?
Again, this kind of hard. It's a difficult assessment to make just because the states themselves are very, very different. California has just slashed its uninsurance rate because their Medicaid expansion just pulled in a huge number of people. New York has had the same success. Something like half, a little over half of New York's enrollments have been in Medicaid. People are seeing much lower rates than they saw in previous years. On the other hand, the bulk of enrollment is on federal exchanges. Only around 14, 15 states are running their own exchange. So just in the aggregate, the federal exchanges matter more, but the individual states that set up their own exchanges, they're the ones where some of the largest numbers of uninsured reside.
Mm-hmm. Yevgeny Feman is our guest for All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays at 1 here on the Ideas Network. He's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and we're covering lots of issues, big focus on international issues. We still have to get to Russia and Ukraine and the U.S., and that will be coming up. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. Rocky is next in Anishkoro. Hi, Rocky.
Hi, how's it going?
All right, Rocky. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Enjoying the rain that we're getting up here by Anishkoro, so...
Good.
Well needed. So do you honestly believe that our country can afford to have all these illegals come in?
That's a good question. I've talked about this a lot with all sorts of people, and I think ultimately we've got to look at why they're illegal first. They're illegal not because of something inherent in the way that they've immigrated, but they're illegal because they violated our immigration laws. Our immigration laws are just poorly designed. They're artifacts of a different century. If we're concerned about immigrants making use of the welfare state right when they move in, we can set up systems to avoid that, to give them waiting periods. We already have those systems set up. Actually, we can extend those waiting periods. But, I mean, ultimately, getting people in, whether they're legal or not, and then making them citizens, giving them the opportunity to pay income taxes, to work here, to become Americans, that's just, no matter how you slice it, it's a huge benefit to the economy. The CBO's done an analysis of a few immigration bills, and all of them just add to the economy. They reduce the federal budget deficit, if that's what you're concerned with. I think it's also a matter of culture. We're a nation of immigrants, and to say that we're gonna say no to people who want to come here and work here. And I'm not talking about the gangs that flow in through Mexico, but people want to come here, work here, raise a family. I mean, it seems very odd to me.
Mm. What do you think, Rocky?
Well, it's. He's stating it's people are coming here that want to work. Are there jobs available? From what I can see, there's not really that many jobs readily available to even the American people that are here. Low-paying jobs at McDonald's, perhaps, maybe, or something like that. But you're adding a lot of people into a situation that's just crazy. Mm. And as far as I can see, you're saying the deficit has decreased. And $18 trillion, as it stands right now, is a decrease? How are you figuring this?
Yevgeny?
Yeah. So with the budget deficit, the CBO said that if we were to implement immigration reform, it would reduce the budget deficit by about $1 trillion over 20 years. That's mainly because you're getting people to start paying taxes. You're getting new immigrants, but also existing immigrants who are illegal that become legalized. They start paying taxes. That becomes easier for them to do that. On the subject of whether there are jobs available, the labor force has shrunk. So a flood of new immigrants would increase the labor force. Most studies that look at immigration find that new immigrants would be complementary, quote-unquote, to use economic language, to the existing labor force. That is, they wouldn't replace American workers, but they'd have skill sets that are complementary. A lot of them would take much lower-skilled work, Others would fill in high-tech niches where we don't have enough people working. You know, we always need more doctors. We always need more scientists, more engineers. Yeah, and honestly, we do always need more people working at McDonald's. It's not great, but for a lot of people, that's how you start off. And if we're concerned about a shrinking labor force right now, that's one great way to expand the labor force. I don't think we really have a lack of jobs available. I think that a lot of the jobs that would be available right now, Americans just aren't taking. Those aren't the jobs they're looking for. The research depends on what research you look at. Some of it agrees with it, some of it doesn't. But broadly, I find it hard to find any serious negative effects from increased immigration.
Thank you, Rocky, very much for your call. We can go back to immigration. I'm sure others will want to talk about it, but I do want to move to Washington, Moscow, Ukraine. Interesting report just in the last couple of days, which was about this accord. I didn't know much about this, that promised a collaboration between America and Russian nuclear scientists, reciprocal visits to atomic sites to work on projects that range from energy to planetary defense. I guess that's not happening right now because of the confrontation between the two countries. There are a lot of questions here. Are there other areas that are off now because of these tensions? And do we have any new information about how closely Moscow was involved in the plane downing and whether or not they're saying that the rebels are acting on their own? You know, is this going to be a source of a lot of tension for the next year?
This is going to be a source of tension for a long time to come, I think definitely longer than even the next year. You know, one thing I read recently also is that Russia is starting to enhance their inspections of a lot of European and U.S.-born foods, and all of a sudden they're starting to find a lot of defects with the food, that it's violating certain Russian health standards. So Russia's trying to respond to these sanctions and international pressure in some, I'll call them cute ways. It's not going to affect anything, but for them it's really about getting domestic political opinion on their side and giving Russians a story to run with. I think the sanctions we have now are probably what we should have done a while ago. We're hitting Russia's oil and natural gas industry. That's their lifeline. I can tell you that there's one project I'm very familiar with. Exxon has made a deal with Rosneft. It's I think the biggest oil company in Russia, and they're helping them explore the Arctic for new sources of oil and natural gas. There are serious depletion concerns in Russia. A lot of people think that the Russian oil and gas supplies are going to run out by the end of the next decade or two. So these exploration deals are very important. With these sanctions, it's not clear whether Exxon's going to be able to legally continue on helping them. So this is going to hit Russia where it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
But Russia's also, you know, in some ways, a sleeping tiger. They do have a lot of domestic support in favor of pushing back against Ukraine, against the West, you know, who they perceive to be Western imperialists. So how Russia's going to react here is hard to predict. Putin has shown to be a little bit unpredictable sometimes. I think ultimately he's acting...
Yes, I say that's true.
He's acting rationally, I think, but he's behaving in a different sort of rationality than what we understand in Western countries. He's concerned with maintaining his leadership rather than making the country a better place.
Mm-hmm. Does he have any kind of grand design?
I think his grand design is most evident by a comment he made on the dissolution of the Soviet Union. He called it one of the greatest geopolitical disasters of the 20th century.
Mm.
I think he sees himself as a kind of savior for Russia from the plutocrats, from the oligopolists, from the oligarchs that became a big part of Russia's economy after the fall of the Soviet Union. His grand design is certainly centralizing power. It's returning a power structure similar to the USSR, but with external capitalism, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. It does. More phone calls in a moment. All Things Political is what you're listening to here on the Ideas Network. Yevgeny Feyman is our guest. He's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to more phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, and Joe in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Joe.
Hi there.
Hi.
I've just got a couple things. First, if the New York police force decided to go after individual criminals by dropping 3,000-pound bombs on the island of Manhattan, thousands of innocent people would die, and suggesting that it's the fault of the criminals that that happened would be ridiculous. I just wanted to point that out.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing applies in Gaza. It's a more populous place than the island of Manhattan, than population density. The other thing is, the way that we get people to do what we want in pretty much all other cases in the United States is to put economic pressure on them. We got Iran to come to the table on the nuclear issue by sanctions, and we should do the same thing with Israel to get them to stop the settlements and the occupation, which have gone on for 50 years, are going on now, and will continue to go on. And it's ridiculous for them to suggest that they should have security while running the world's only violently enforced state-sanctioned colonial settler movement against the wishes of the entire world and the Geneva Convention.
And what do you do about the rockets that are being launched at Israel and the desire for at least Hamas and some others to not have Israel be there? What do you do with that part of the equation?
I would say that when the 50-year-long war crime against the Palestinian people ceases, that it's possible that the Hamas will lose any credibility that they have. But as long as that goes on, as long as, the only people they've been pushed towards the sea or the river in this case are the Palestinians. Yet there's all of this talk about how they plan to push the Israelis into the sea. Well, that's never happened, but they've been pushed back immensely. And for 50 years, their generations of their lives have been destroyed. Once that stops, a group like Hamas will lose all credibility. It's the settlers who are the problem.
Thank you for your call. Yevgeny.
Well, there was a lot there. The settlers are a very small portion of Israel. They settle in the West Bank in previous years Israel has pulled back all settlers from Gaza. They've pulled back some from the West Bank. Ultimately, I agree. The settlements need to stop. But, if you want to get into the history here, 1947, 1948, in 1947, Palestinians revolted against Israel in protest of the UN-brokered partition plan, which was a terrible, terrible plan. It was never to work, but they responded with violence. They waged war against Israel. In 1948, a number of Arab countries launched a war against Israel. After Israel won that war with the help of the U.S., with financing from the U.S., help from the U.K. as well, these Arab countries refused to take in Palestinian refugees, and the ones that they did take in, they treated horribly. They dumped them into refugee camps where a lot of them starved. There were squalid conditions. This goes on. There have been numerous wars, and in a few of them, Israel was an aggressor. In others, Israel was defending itself. You look at the first and second intifadas that began in the late 80s, the second intifada late 90s, early 2000. These were attacks against Israeli civilians. They weren't responses to settlements. They weren't responses to some kind of massive genocide. There is no massive genocide. They were an attempt to disrupt peace negotiations. They were attempts to delegitimize Israel. This isn't to say that Israel takes no blame here, but to pretend that this is just a 50-year-old war crime and Israel is creating an apartheid state. That seems a little bit disingenuous.
You mentioned this earlier, but it is so sad, isn't it, that there are certain issues that seems that almost seem intractable, that we talk about them and administrations take them on and make a wee bit of progress, and then we're back to the kind of violence. It just goes on and on and on and on.
Exactly. And, you know, when you talk about Israel and Palestine, I avoid delving into the history because playing the blame game doesn't help a lot. I try to focus on what's happening at the moment. And right now it's very difficult right now to make any kind of progress. I think when you start focusing on the history, when you start trying to figure out, well, who threw the first stone, it gets that much more difficult.
Yes, right. Thank you, Joe, very much for your call. Pat in Milwaukee, hello.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just getting back to the immigration issue a little bit, I guess one of my pet peeves I have with the whole issue is, you know, the phrase, and you guys repeated it, you know, we're a land of immigrants. And yes, you know, I get that. Every country is a land of immigrants. We've all come from somewhere to establish, you know, a life for ourselves. Here's my problem. When people come into America and they say they really, really want to be American citizens and assimilate into the culture, and then they send 75% of their money back home. I understand they're trying to support their family. But the problem I have is if the CBO and the Chamber of Commerce and they're relying on all these folks to come over and help take jobs and improve the economy, I guess there was an article, I believe it was in the New York Times this morning, just Honduras alone, where there's less than a million refugees, illegal immigrants, and legal immigrants from Honduras in this country. In the past year, they've sent over $5 billion back to Honduras. And you know, my position is if you truly want to become an American citizen and start a life for yourself in America, you need to buy in 100%. You need to eventually become a citizen the legal way. You need to bring your family over, and you can't just come over here and use the American economic engine to send money back home. That, to me, that's not truly assimilating. That's not the spirit of immigration. And I think, you know, one of the things Congress needs to do is look at those the wire transactions that go back to these countries and either tax the heck out of it so they don't do it or figure out how to keep those dollars back in the United States, which is actually going to help the economy and in turn help the immigrants themselves.
Thanks, Pat. Yevgeny.
You know, so when the CBO did their estimate, they said it would increase both GDP and GNP. So GDP is just based on the geographical location of production. GNP, gross national product, it focuses on production based on ownership. So even when you factor in the remittances going overseas, it's a net increase to the economy. You know, and I think we have to look at why they send remittances. They're usually not sending remittances because their relatives really want to remain in a hovel in Honduras or stuck in Mexico City where gang warfare explodes every single day. They're staying there because they can't come across. You have a lot of people who have come over legally, but find it very, very difficult to bring across their family. They're lucky to get a green card. Oftentimes, their family members might be disqualified from getting a green card because they're not, quote-unquote, immediate family members. Getting one for your grandparents can be pretty difficult. So I agree that some level of cultural assimilation is necessary. I agree we want people to really identify with being Americans first and whatever other nationality second. But we already make it very difficult for them to do that. Loosening our immigration laws, first of all, that's what would help. They'd suddenly see America is a better place in every way, shape, and form. There's no reason for my relatives, for my kids, my grandparents, my husband, whatever, to remain in the country that I left. They can come along with me, and the U.S. is making it very easy for me to do that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Pat, for your call. Well, let's talk a little more politics here for a moment. It's amazing to me that we're getting pretty close to midterm elections, and we're not hearing a whole lot of talk about what's going on. So give me your assessment. Are the Republicans closer to taking the Senate or farther away?
Again, you know, this is reading the tea leaves of politics.
Right.
Every forecasting model that I've seen has said that Republicans have a better than 50% chance of retaking the Senate. So if I were to put money on it, I'd say that Republicans are probably going to retake the Senate. That being said, if I were a Republican strategist, I wouldn't advise them to rest on their laurels. There's still a lot that they can be doing with immigration, for instance. You know, when it comes to the ACA and healthcare reform, that's going to have to wait till 2017, no matter what. So I can understand why they're hesitant there. But you know, we know who's the majority leader. We know who the whip is. We've got Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise, respectively, and both are definitely improvements. I think they're a little bit more pragmatic. Kevin McCarthy's opposed the Export-Import Bank. He supported a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants. Steve Scalise, a little bit less so, but he has opposed the Export-Import Bank, again, which does break from the kind of traditional pro-business GOP and is indicative more of a pro-market GOP, which resounds much better with voters. It gives them a good position to hit Democrats on. You know, we're going to have to wait and see. I think I hope by beginning of October we'll have a clearer picture of what's going on with the elections. But there are all sorts of things that can happen in the meantime. Republicans are going to keep hitting Democrats on foreign policy. They're going to keep hitting them on the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
And for better or worse, when it comes to the ACA, public opinion is with them.
Yeah. How much money is involved in midterms this go around? A lot?
You know, I haven't been looking too much at the money being thrown around here, but I think much of it, the most important money, is coming through the PACs, the political action committees, and the super PACs, the ones established under the Citizens United decision. You know, there's literally billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
The campaign contributions, the reason I say they matter less is because they can do less to influence actual votes. You know, we saw with Eric Cantor, his opponent was completely underfunded and still won, despite how much money Eric Cantor's campaign threw at the campaign. You need much more than money to win an election now.
And finally, because we're interviewing John Dean, the second hour of our program today, about all those recorded conversations, Nixon's defense, Nixon's Watergate. As we look at this 40th anniversary of his resignation, is there anything that you think we ought to remember about Watergate that should apply to political lessons we should put in place today?
You know, I think when it comes down to it, we have to hold both executives and legislators, but especially executives, to a very high standard. I think I made it pretty clear. I don't support the House GOP lawsuit against President Obama, but I think that we've grown a little bit too comfortable with our executives taking executive prerogative, running government through executive orders. This applies not only to President Obama. I would have applied it to President Bush as well. We've got to hold them to a higher standard. They're supposed to be morally better than your average American. That's what we hope.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've moved away from that over the past few decades.
Evgeny, thank you. You're so fair. Thank you. You really are. Thank you for being. Yeah, you are. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Yeah, our guest this hour, and we thank him for joining us again. Evgeny Feyman, he is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He knows a lot about a lot of foreign policy issues and domestic issues. He's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute who really has a specialty of healthcare policy, entitlement reform, and the Affordable Care Act. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson and KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Please stay with us. All Things Political, you always hear Mondays at 1, just to put it in your head to listen again next Monday for this hour. John Dean is with us, hour 2 of our program today, who has spent the last 4 years listening to Richard Nixon's defense. And his latest book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It.